And there was this very stratified type of society there. I was born to this unique group of elites from America, and I kind of grew up a little bit like a princess, very spoiled, you know, in my big house in a country that was dirt poor and that I was so used to. I feel like I didn't see a lot of what was going on around me until 1980, when this whole bubble just burst. There was a military coup led by enlisted members of the Liberian Armed Forces. They stormed the mansion. They executed the president. They executed 13 members of his cabinet, including my cousin, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. My father was shot. My mother was attacked. I had many family members who were killed. And my whole world sort of came apart at the time. And my family ran away. My mom took me and my sister and brought us here to the U.S. And my father, who had been shot during the coup, followed us to North Carolina when he had recovered from his wounds. And so I went to high school here in the United States and then on to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I majored in journalism in large part because, A, I'd read All the President's Men in high school, and B, because I never wanted to be surprised again the way I was when I was at 13 years of age. My whole world exploded, and I hadn't seen all of this inequity that was around me, all this social turmoil that was going on that I had been completely blind to. And I wanted to never live again in that kind of a bubble. And I think that's a lot of what drew me to journalism and why I ended up doing what I do now.
Now, as we get into the book, one of the things that I think is interesting right now, so many of the wars that are taking place and conflicts are between ethnic groups and religions. And in the case of Liberia, it really wasn't exactly that. It was more about where you came from. Could you sort of set in context what it means to be Congo versus the country people?
I can, but it devolves then into ethnic
later
war
down, uh-huh.
Once we get to the Civil War. But these two classes that we talked about, the descendants of the freed American slaves who were called the Congo people for complicated reasons versus the native Liberians who were derogatorily called the country people. And these two classes sort of were at this very uneasy peace for 150 years. It was a very imbalanced type of system that was in many ways 95% of the wealth in the country was concentrated in the hands of 5% of the population. And so you can imagine kind of what was going on during all of that time. After the 1980 coup, Samuel Doe was the president, took over. He was the one who led the coup. And what he ended up doing, it's like you just see this happening again and again. It was the exact same thing as the freed American slaves. You know, he then installed his ethnic group, the Crown people, in charge, and they took over all the wealth, and they subjugated everybody else. And that's what led to this attempted coup in 1985 that landed Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in jail for a year. And that led to the Charles Taylor invasion of Liberia in 1989, that devolved into a complete ethnic war. The civil war in Liberia that then lasted for 14 years was the Crown people versus the Gio and Mana people who had been subjugated and attacked and brutalized and killed by the Crown, and they turned on them. And so we ended up right where we often do, is each group in Liberia took over. They went and turned their fire on other ethnic groups.
And how many people died or were dislocated?
200,000 people. The population, when I left Liberia, we were 2 million people in 1980. Liberian population now is like between 3.5 and 4 million. But 200,000 people, you go to Liberia, and there's not a single human being who is not a survivor of unimaginable horror. Everybody you see walking on the street, and Liberians are really, we're really vivacious and happy and joking the worst, most un-PC, awful jokes in the middle of a war, and the Liberians will be doing it. But you just probe a little bit and dig a little bit under the surface, and everybody has some horrific story to tell. That's like it's very ripe ground for a reporter when I'm there as a reporter and I'm talking to people. But it also also constantly strikes me with wonder just at the enormous resilience of my people. when Ebola happened, there was never a question in my mind that Liberians would come out of it, because we had gone through, we had fought many worse demons than that.
You know, when you look at, if you imagine that you were looking at Ellen Sirleaf's resume, and you'd see president, and you'd see World Bank, Harvard degree, I mean, it's quite incredible. But then if you really go back when she was in her late teens, it could have turned out very differently. I mean, she married at what age?
17.
17 and had four boys.
One after the other. Within 4 years, she had four boys.
So how did she go from there with her one and only husband, Doc Sirleaf, to going to Harvard?
So she got married at 17 because her father had had a stroke when she was 15. And that was a huge change of fortune for the family, because the family no longer had his income to depend on, and so she couldn't go to college when she graduated from high school. So she went for the next best thing, which was immediate marriage to the first guy that came along, who's Doc Sirleaf. He had just come back to the Liberia fresh from getting his degree at Tuskegee. He had a very military bearing. He was very good looking, but that sort of masked what was underneath, which was a pretty brutal guy. They got married, and they were initially happy at first, but she had one child after the other. And this is a woman who, from early on, was pretty ambitious. And at the age of 21, with four young boys, one of them under the age of one, she looked sort of at her life and thought, this can't possibly be it for me. I'm going to be old before my time, carrying these children to and fro. Her husband was already starting to show signs of brutality, and he got a scholarship to go to get a graduate degree in Wisconsin, and she took that as her ticket out of there and said, I'm coming with you. And she went and got herself a scholarship to go to college at Madison Business College, which meant that they were going to leave the four young boys in Liberia with their mothers.
And that was sort of accepted, right?
It was not? Liberians, the extended family will look after children. That part, yes. The mom leaving the kids and going to, no.
Okay.
You know, the moms did not leave four boys and go get their college degree. And that was a big deal for her to do that. And she made she made this seminal decision at that time, but is a decision that women all over the world make over and over and over again, and that's children or career. And she went for a career, and she has been haunted about that until this day. There's so much guilt that every time you talk to her about it, the whole idea of her abandoning her sons comes up. Even though she went back to Liberia after 2 years, and then she came back to she was in and out of their lives. But that guilt about leaving her sons and not being
there. Tell the story about the
there,
baptism.
I was in Liberia in 2014 during the Ebola epidemic. And this was at the height of Ebola. And I was there reporting for the New York Times. But during that time, I also was spending a lot of time interviewing her for this book. I had followed her up country to Banga. We had spent the whole day. It had been an exhausting day. We had been going to Ebola treatment centers. We had been going to all these health around and around and around. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and we're back. She has a house. There's a government house compound in Banga, and we went in. She was amped up, and we're talking. And I'm asking her questions about, because her initial response to Ebola had been very slow. And in the middle of all of this, she starts talking about her son, Adama, the youngest boy, the one who was he was like 8 months old when she left him. He's like 58 years old now. And she starts talking about how he had never been baptized. And I was like, what? And she was like, he doesn't have any godparents. And it's just, to this day, I feel like the worst mother, because he doesn't have, he does. And granted, in Liberia, Liberians are like the most religious people you'll ever meet, even though we believe in everything. But the whole baptism and God, we're deeply, ostentatiously Christians, except for the 35% who are Muslim. You get baptized. I feel like I can remember my own baptism, and there were like 12 godparents standing there in white, even though I was a baby, so I can't really remember it. But I have godparents coming out my ears. And she started going on and on, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, it's in the middle of Ebola, and I'm sitting there going, looking at her thinking, women carry so much internal baggage that they beat themselves up about day in, you know, that you wouldn't even begin to think about, that we're in the middle of this catastrophe and you're here talking about how, you know, 58 years ago you didn't baptize Ademus or Leif? Seriously? I mean, but that's like, it's, and there's, mm-hmm. there's so many, she's a really complicated woman,
and like
her, she's gotten accused, rightfully so, of nepotism, of appointing her sons to high government offices, and she doesn't, and you'd think somebody like her, who is so politically astute, would have known better than to do something that tone deaf, but when it comes to her sons, because I think of this guilt, she's got a blind spot.
But like you said, she was just, or is, so ambitious. And at one point, she had her job as a civil servant, and yet she was going to Liberia sort of on vacation or whatever to get involved in politics. And she really got caught in that. I mean, how did she decide which way to go, and how was she able to keep her job? Was it sort of the World Bank saying, all right, we'll let you do this? Or I mean,
people always tell her no, and she does what she wants anyway. Yeah. She had, when the military coup in 1980 happened, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was the Minister of Finance of Liberia at the time. 13 cabinet members were executed on the beach by firing squad for, you know, running the country into the ground and all these other accusations that Doe made. The Minister of Finance, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, was not. All her other colleagues were killed, but she was spared because she's a woman.
Yeah.
But also because she had some street cred, because she had criticized the government that she worked for. And so people believed that she saw things. She was more aware than others. After the coup, she worked for Doe for a few months, and then she quit when she realized that he was going to be as bad as the people before him. And then came to the U.S., where she went to work, back to work for Citibank and the World Bank, and she's going around establishing her banking credentials. She took a job with Equator Bank before she had told Citibank she was leaving. Both banks thought she was working for them. In the meantime, she's in Liberia campaigning to be running for the Liberian Senate in 1985, and she gets herself arrested and put in prison. And so both Citibank and Equator Bank are lobbying the government to get her released, and they actually put aside, and it's the sort of things that, and this happened to her again when she was working for the United Nations in the 1990s, and she decided that she was going to run against Charles Taylor for president of Liberia, even though the civil war is still going on in Liberia. And she goes to Liberia, she goes to Liberia and starts campaigning and giving interviews to BBC. And Kofi Annan calls and he's like, what the? What do you think you're doing? And she's like, oh yeah, okay, my resignation will be on your desk on Monday. And so, but she's still she does this.
She liked that
UN
salary.
Yeah. She did this stuff and still managed to maintain these relationships with these people, even though she constantly was, her whole life is doing this kind of stuff.
Well, clearly her background at the UN and at the banks really, you know, and there's so many things that she tried to do and has accomplished as president, but I think since we're in the town of George W. Bush, people would be very interested in how she eliminated that incredible amount of debt, $4.7 billion that involved Bush and some others.
Bush loves her, and she loves Bush. You know, she tolerates Obama. She kind of liked Obama, but Bush, she's like, you know, because Bush and Liberians love Bush because at least the Liberians who hated Charles Taylor love Bush because they think he largely helped to get rid of Charles Taylor. When Ellen Johnson Sirleaf became president, Liberia had $4.7 billion in debt. We had been we'd come this close to being kicked out of the IMF. We didn't qualify for any kind of new borrowing, and the country was in this post-war apocalyptic hell. If ever a place needed an infusion of cash, it was Liberia, and we couldn't get it. And there's only one person in the universe of Liberians who could possibly have gone through the kind of complicated hoops required to get that debt forgiven, and it's Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and that's because she knew that system. She'd worked for the IMF and the World Bank and the UN, and she started off first with, you know, Bush put a set of hurdles on her way and said the U.S. would back the debt because the U.S. was Liberia's biggest donor, and to get everybody else to fall in line behind the U.S., you needed for Bush to sort of bless this, and he said he would do it if she turned over Charles Taylor. Now, she didn't even have Charles Taylor at the time. Charles Taylor was, you know, under in Nigeria, where he was supposed to have been given safe passage, you know, provided he leave the country. And so she had to get the Nigerian government to turn him over. He ran away. It was this daring escape to the Chad border. It was, like, ridiculous. But, of course, they found him, and the Nigerians said they would only turn him over to a democratically elected Liberian government. Now, the last thing she wanted after 14 years of civil war was to have Charles Taylor come back and be turned over to Liberia, because he still had a huge number of followers in Liberia and people who supported him. So that was sort of this big secret negotiation, and she said, you know, he'll only be, you know, you bring him to Liberia, he'll only be on Liberian soil for like 30 minutes. I don't want any Liberian soldiers anywhere near him. Give me white soldiers. It was, the whole thing was hilarious, and they tried to keep it from the press, but the press found out anyway, and the only thing that she lucked out, and there was this horrific rainstorm just as he touched down on Liberian soil, and it was raining too hard for people to get to the plane, and they hustled him to the helicopter, and you know, so he was only on Liberian soil for like 30 minutes. But that was a big deal. And once she cleared that and turned him over to the International War Crimes Tribunal for him to be tried, the U.S. sort of blessed the debt deal. And that started a chain of events that led her to getting, she got U2 and Bono to shame the IMF because they were dragging their feet, and, you know, got
George
Bono,
Soros too.
George Soros. Bono gave this famous quote that, you know, she and he like cooked up together, where he said it was an IMFing outrage that the IMF was holding up Liberia's debt forgiveness, and this published in the Financial Times and the meeting of the big IMF spring meetings in Washington. And she was, I mean, she got into cahoots with this like gonzo journalist from England, who has this website with the fedora hat and the trench coat. He looks straight out of like the 1920s or something like that, and, you know, got him to go to some poor Liberian village where people were building their huts with mud and talk about this poor country, and these awful donors are trying to, you know, vulture funds or dragging this poor country through the mud, and just shamed everybody basically into getting this debt forgiven. She got it done.
It was
masterful.
Now, that's one of her great successes, but you've talked about the nepotism. What are some of the other things that she would say that she did not succeed on, and did she get ahead of the Ebola crisis quickly enough?
Corruption, to answer your first question. Liberia is still enormously corrupt. It's endemic in Liberian society. Every interaction sometimes you feel like you're having is transactional. She's fired corrupt officials, but she doesn't prosecute them because she made a decision early on that she was going to pick her battles. Even though she said, you know, I'm coming to office with zero tolerance for corruption, but that was rubbish because the people, her government officials are enormously, you know, corrupt. They're getting indicted left and right all over the place, or getting fired left and right all over the place. So she hasn't done enough on that. I think the nepotism is a very real issue. But on the plus side, she's opened the country to, she's opened up both freedom of speech and freedom of the press to levels that Liberians have never seen any before in their lives, which is why her initial response to Ebola was very weak. She was in denial at first when Ebola first crossed the border from Guinea into and Sierra Leone into Liberia at Gwekadu, which is this meeting point. It's like Grand Central Station, where you have Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia right there. It's a very vibrant market scene. And Liberia came, Ebola entered the country, and for the first few months, she was in denial because she didn't want word about this getting out. She didn't want it to stop foreign investment. She didn't want people to think of Ebola and equate that with Liberia. And so she didn't get a hold of it really quickly. However, because Liberia has now opened up freedom of speech and freedom of the press to the level that she had, Liberians went crazy, and they held her government to account. And so whereas in Sierra Leone and in Guinea, the government response was slower because you didn't have quite those levels of people, you know, demanding action on the radio and that sort of thing. And also because Ebola in Sierra Leone and Guinea happened further up country, it didn't enter the city the way it did in entering Monrovia, an urban city. The Liberian response, when it finally got going, you know, outstripped everybody else, and Liberia came out of it quicker than the other two countries, even though it was hit harder.
You know, some people have said one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton was not elected was that women didn't come out as much as she had hoped. But that certainly was not the case in Ellen's election. Tell us about the role that women played. And, you know, some people might call this voter fraud. Others people won't. But let's, and you said earlier that this was one of your favorite questions, and we Americans have a hang-up about this stuff. But
so like,
go ahead.
I wrote my little women chapters, and all of a sudden everybody's like, voter fraud, voter fraud. It's not voter fraud. It's like, you know, it's... There's another word for it. Disenfranchisement. How's that?
Okay,
is that better?
Yeah.
The women to understand.
Or bribery.
the women, the Liberian women, got Ellen Johnson Sirleaf elected president. She was elected on the backs of this women's movement. These women had been through hell during the Liberian Civil War for 14 years. They had been 70% had been raped. Their children had been stolen from them and turned into child soldiers. They had gone through an apocalypse that you can't even begin to imagine. And throughout all of this, these women drove the economy anyway. While the men were fighting, these women were the market women. They were going up to the border. They were getting oranges and Maggi bouillon cubes and rice and bringing it back into the city to feed a starving population. They kept what little economy that there was in the country going. And they finally got to the point that the war was over. And in many ways, they were the ones who were demanding for peace, demanding peace in their white t-shirts in the football fields. And they got to the point where the war was over, and they determined that they were going to get a woman elected president because they believed that a woman would not take the country back to war. They were not going to tolerate what the country had just been through. And so they mobilized. At the beginning of the voter registration period, only 15% of the people of the voters were women who were registered. By the end, it was 51% because these women went door to door. They went to the market stalls with babysitters saying, we'll mine your market for you. We will sell your oranges. You go register and vote. And they did this huge turnout effort. And then when the first round of elections, because there were so many different, candidates running. And so the first round is just everybody. There are like 22 candidates running, and it boils it down to the top two finishers. And the top two finishers were George Weah, a football player, who's number one, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, a 67-year-old Harvard-educated global bureaucrat. Now, the football player didn't have a proper college degree. He didn't. He'd never worked in government or business before, but he was a really good football player. And then you have, on the other side, this woman with experience oozing out of every pore. And all of the young boys, because they're young boys, were going to vote for the football player. But shockingly, the men all lined up behind the football player, too. And then they accused the women of being sexist, who were voting for Ellen. And the women weren't going to have that. And they were like, screw this. So they go after... they went after the young boys who were planning on voting for George Weah, and their moms stole their voter ID cards. they went into bars where they would offer these guys beer if they traded their voter ID cards. A lot of these boys thought that they had voted in the first round, and so they were done anyway. And so the women were happy to continue tricking them. And they, you know, traded beers and money and stuff for their voter ID cards. And on election day, there were women passing because if you were pregnant or if you were a nursing mother, you could go to the front of the line. And these were lines that were like 10, 12 hours long. There were women passing the same baby around. Here, borrow my baby. You can go to the front of the line. So they were, it was that, I mean, that's not voter fraud.
No.
That's not voter fraud. That's just women being fed up and saying, we're going to get a woman elected president.
So one of the biggest successes or achievements for her will be when she steps down. And tell us, I mean, there's no question she is definitely going to
Thank
leave
God.
Office.
The whole while I was working on the book, I was like, if this woman doesn't step down in 2017, my book is dead. because this is as you know, in Africa, we don't step down our presidents. They stay until they, you know, for 50, 60 years. Look at Mugabe. It was really important, you know, if I'm writing this book about the first woman president, it's like, it's a journalistic book, and it's not, you know, it's by no means do I think it's a puff book, but it is uplifting because I do think that she is the best that we had. And so I was really worried that if she goes and like pulls some Paul Biya Cameroon stuff and doesn't leave, you know, that would be, but she's stepping down. And we're going to, for the first time in Liberian history, we're going to have an example of a post-president. We don't even know what to do with that because we've never had a live former president. Yeah.
And she'll be able to stay there. And,
yeah. She says she claims she's going to hang out on her farm.
Because that just doesn't happen.
No, I mean, no.
All right, well, we just touched upon just a little bit of what's in the book, and it really is just delightful. You know, I'm so used to reading Helene's, like here, I mean, serious, uh-oh, after chemical attack, asking if U.S. remarks embolden Assad. I mean, the serious writing New York Times.
This is my life, yeah.
And then when you see this, you can just tell that it's a release for her because you see a bit of this sort of sassiness that comes out in her writing, and it's such fun. But before I turn it over to the audience, you know, you have been covering a pretty interesting administration. So
I'm hiding at the Pentagon.
Yeah, you're hiding at the
totally
Pentagon.
I'm totally hiding.
So what are your friends at State saying?
My friends are State.
We're really interested because many of us in this room have known Mr.
Absolutely.
Tillerson. And
the situation in the State Department is ridiculous. I mean, Rex Tillerson, and all of a sudden, like, people are like, oh, yeah, he said something bad about Syria, so now he's great. But Rex Tillerson, for 2 months, he doesn't travel with press anymore. He said that he doesn't feel he needs to speak to the press. I don't think he understands that we're there to communicate. We're like his way to talk to the American people, and he's a servant of the American people, which is why he talks to the press. I don't think he understands the whole idea of a free press and what role we serve. And that's pretty shocking. The State Department has been gutted in many ways. There's so many career civil servants who've left. All the political people have left, which is normal, but a lot of people there were career, and then ascended into what could be called political jobs, but they were still career civil servants. And there was sort of a push, and so a lot of them are gone now. But beyond that, it's not just the State Department, it's the NSC, you know, the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. You go in there now, and it's crickets. It's empty. There are these nameplates on the door, but with no names on them because they still haven't. I mean, part of that is because Michael Flynn flamed out, and so McMaster's is just getting back going. But it's taking him time to build up a staff. And so he's getting there, and he's clearly starting to assert himself the same way at the Pentagon, Jim Mattis has started to assert himself. And so you have these former generals and present day generals who are now in many ways taking control of American national security policy. And Trump seems to love Mattis, and he's listening to Mattis. It's Mattis and McMaster's who sort of prodded him in the Syria direction, and part of the reason why you had that strike. I mean, if you look at the chain of events over the past 10 days, it's incredible. On March 30th, you had Nikki Haley, who now is Miss Assad must go. Nikki Haley and Rex Tillerson, Mr. Assad must go now too. Mm-hmm. On March 30th, the two of them, within hours of each other, stood up and said publicly that it was no longer American policy to get rid of Assad. It was no longer a focus of the Trump administration. And Tillerson went even further than that and said that that's up to the Syrian people. That was a seismic change in how the U.S. had presented itself over there, and people took notice of that. And then on Tuesday, you have this chemical weapons attack. Now, nobody but Assad is to blame for that chemical weapons attack, but you have to think about what kind of messaging the United States is sending when you have your Secretary of State and the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. standing up publicly and saying, we don't care about it. He can stay if he wants. So, you know, that's the implication of, you know, of what they're standing up there and saying. And so you see them both flip. And now Nikki Haley is talking about, you know, Assad must go, and Tillerson is, you know, and all of that. And I know that at the Pentagon, when they said what they did on March 30th, people at the Pentagon were furious. They were so angry that a lot of the gender, there was so much talking within the building about what are they doing? This is not the sort of thing you ever say, even if you believe that. Even if you think that at the end of the day you need a strong man in Syria, which is what many, many people think, that this country is not, it would be too much of a mess, actually, if he did step aside. Even if you think that, you don't say that because you're sending a different message.
So what are your sources at the Pentagon saying about what Syrian policy should be or is.
Nobody knows Syrian policy should be or is, and that's the problem. Obama didn't know, and Trump doesn't know. It's so incredibly complicated, and it's so easy to criticize both Obama and Trump. It's so, on Syria, it's enormously easy to sit back and criticize because it's so, there's nothing that you do that doesn't have five different, you know, consequences that you can, you know, it's, but coming up with, I've yet to hear anybody who can actually stand up and articulate a way forward in Syria that doesn't have a huge, huge number of trade-offs.
Do you think that one of the reasons the positions haven't been filled at the State Department is because President Trump really doesn't want to fill them and it's a way to sort of decapitate the department?
I don't think he's thought it through at that to that extent. I don't know. You raised, that's a good question. That's a good point. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
And then finally, before we open it up, Russia's involvement in the elections has continues to be a story. Will it generate as much ink a year from now?
Yes. I think that's gonna be going on for a while. I think there's a lot of threads that are still being pulled. And I think it will continue to be a story. I think Trump is clearly worried that this is going to continue to be a story. I think that could be part of why he has demonized both the press and the intel community. And that's in a lot of ways, I think, it's to discredit, because he's fearful that
other stuff is going to
come.
And started
doing that so early. Yeah. Yeah. Because he's worried that other stuff could come out.
Let's open it up. I know this audience always has questions, and we have two mics, Tom and Alana. Raise your hands, please. My goodness. There we go. Our honorary consul from Sierra Leone,
yes,
Consul
sir.
Jackson.
Welcome, Ms. Cooper.
Hello.
I'm, of course, Patrick Jackson, the honorary consul for Sierra Leone, the next door Liberia. I've got two questions, and I'm going to try to ask both of them now, because if I know, Jamie might not give me another opportunity.
He's not.
The first question is, you did talk here and there about Mrs. Shalit's nepotism, and did that come up in your conversation with her at any point in time? And if it did, I'd like to know what she thought about what she was doing. And the other question is, you mentioned something about her stepping down this year. You said she's going to step down in 2017. Is there any timetable, and is she keeping up to that timetable?
On the nepotism, yes, I did ask her about it many times. The main issue for her is Rob Sirleaf, which is her third son. And she put him in charge. Charles Sirleaf, one of her other sons, was on the Liberian Central Bank. But he was appointed to that position before she became president. So her excuse there is that she's not the one who appointed him, which is technically true. She did not appoint him. He was appointed before she became. Rob Sirleaf, however, she appointed to head NOCAL, which is the Liberian, they discovered oil off the coast of Liberia a few years ago. And so, yeah, we're going to go down the tubes with Nigeria now. And she put Rob in charge of the Liberian oil company. And so this, you can imagine, this is potentially, this could be hugely lucrative. And to put her son in charge of that just like sent people crazy. And she kept him there. He eventually resigned a couple of years ago, but it was after several years. And every time I asked her about this, she said, I needed somebody. Her response is, I needed somebody there I could trust. There are too many corrupt people here, and I knew I could trust him. And
good to have family close.
It's,
we've heard
yes,
that before.
That's what
lately.
She says. I don't think that's a legit answer. On the timetable, the Liberian elections this year take place in October, and then there will be a runoff, because it's hard to imagine that with the 20 characters we have running, that one of them will get 50% of the vote. And so the runoff will be in November, and she steps down in January. That is the timetable. She's not staying.
You know, one of the things that we really didn't talk about much was you mentioned how she'd been abused by Doc Sirleaf, but tell people a bit more about that, because I mean, she really was threatened and took a lot of courage to walk away.
Yeah, she was beat. I mean, he beat her fairly regularly. He put a gun to her head. She has a mark on her throat to this day, you know, 45 years later from when he tried to strangle her. And he was, I mean, he was hugely abusive, and he was very jealous when she got a job as a junior debt division official at the Ministry of Finance in Liberia, and this was a huge job for a young woman at the time after they'd come back from Wisconsin, and he was very jealous of her work. He started having affairs, and so she started having affairs too, and he found out about her affair, and he went crazy and came and caught her at her boyfriend's house, and he beat her all the way home. He threatened to kill her in front of her. The straw that broke the camel's back was when he threatened to kill her in front of their 8-year-old son, Charles, and he was waving a gun in front of her, and Charles grabbed a can of mosquito repellent and went charging at his father to spray him in the eyes. And that's sort of like, she was, you know, this is so typical Liberian. She was so embarrassed that he ashamed her in front of her son that she walked out. That was what ended it for her. So she doesn't like talking, though, about this, which I think you can make a real criticism about that, because domestic abuse is so prevalent in Liberia. There's so many women in Liberia who have suffered from this, that having Ellen Johnson Sirleaf stand up and publicly talk about this would be huge. It would be huge to stand up as an example to all of these women who've been abused, that this is, you can come out of that and you can make something of your life. However, she has chosen to not talk about this very much publicly because she doesn't want to hurt her sons. She doesn't want to say anything bad about their father in front of them. These are 55, 56, 57, 60-year-old men. But there again, the relationship with the son, the sons thing, there's a lot of interesting threads in there. And she's they say you got to kind of be in love with a subject to do a book on it. I found her to be a really incredible and admirable woman, but she's hugely complicated, you know, and there's a lot of dark there, you know.
Did she give you a lot of time?
She gave me a lot of time, yeah. It was funny because we started out when I went to her and said I wanted to do this book and I wanted to follow her around, and she was like, okay, you know, she wasn't crazy about the idea, but you could also see the, okay, Liberian journalist, works for the New York Times. If there's ever going to be a book about me, this is my best bet. I should probably cooperate with this. And so so she let me in and let me, you know, and we started off, and I was really nervous at first. I've been trying to get a book leave from the Times when I was covering the Obama White House because I hated covering the White House. And they told me that if I stayed for the whole first term, I could have 2013 off to go to Liberia and work on my book. So in 2013, I go to Liberia, and I start following her around. And I was really nervous at first because this woman had just won a Nobel Peace Prize. It was like, and I wanted to get real with her. But my questions at first were very, you could tell I was nervous, and I spoke to her in American English. She's fluent. She can speak Liberian English, and she can speak American English. I can speak Liberian English. I can speak American English. For some reason, the first few months, I was talking to her only in American English. And she was answering me in American English, and we were having these stilted conversations. And I wasn't getting anything. And then one time, we're going up country, and we stopped at a market, and we both started talking to the market woman on the side of the road, because I was in the back seat of her car with her, interviewing her with my laptop on my lap. And we stop, and we both start talking to this market woman. We didn't realize we were both speaking Liberian English to her, and then we just continued it when we got back in the car. And then I'm like, wait a second, why is she telling me all this good stuff all of a sudden? And then she's just said, open up, and she's like, and she just got real. And then it took like an hour for me to realize that we were speaking to each other in Liberian English. I hadn't even realized we had made that shift. And after that, we only talk now, well, I'll only let her talk to me now in Liberian English, and you get a lot more. I got a lot more that way. It was sort of a breakthrough moment for me.
And there's a little bit of Liberian English in here, and let me tell you, it's hard to decipher.
It's not that hard to decipher.
I went to Virginia, you know. I know they speak that at Chapel Hill, but they don't in Virginia.
as long as you remember it's Chapel Hill. Don't stretch.
Any other questions here? Yes, sir. Wait for the microphone. There you go.
Thank you for coming. You're extremely interesting. Thank you. How about the four sons? Anyone with ambitions to become president of Liberia?
Rob, the troublesome one who was head of the National Oil Company, ran for the Senate in 2000, and when was it? It was a few years ago, and he lost. And I think once he lost he wasn't able to win the Senate seat. I hope he realized then that he could not win a Liberian national presidential seat. So none of them are running for president this year. And I think Rob is the one with the most political ambition, but he's so polarizing because people see him as like he's the son that she put in charge of the oil company. So.
Now, I may be totally wrong on this because I've been wrong on a few times tonight.
Like calling me from Duke.
But, you know, you hear so much about the Nigerian diaspora, Ethiopia, and other countries, but I feel like we don't hear as much about the diaspora from Liberia.
Because we're small. We're only 2 million people. Now we're like barely 4 million people. You know how many people in Nigeria? 200 million. They're like bullies. They're total bullies. If you're from Sierra Leone, surely you feel bullied by like Nigerians. I can't stand them. I'm joking. We always say that.
West Nigerians
African.
Are going to buy your book now.
West African. No, let me back up a second. Yeah. West Africans, we're all jealous of the Nigerians because they're like, they're big, they've got money, they've got oil, they've got a great literature, they've got culture.
Growing
and they're
libraries.
Just in your face.
Okay, we have two questions and we'll call it a night. Yes, sir, or ma'am, I can't see. Go, yep.
Thank you so much for coming. A few of my friends are here, and we all read your book, House at Sandy Beach, and absolutely loved it and followed
Thank
your career
you.
Since. But I'm very curious as to your insight or counsel advice on us as Americans. Obviously, Liberia overcome great hurdles with systemic assaults for women to now having a female in the highest branch of the office. And as a country, we're still accepting female leadership in executive office. What advice could you give us from your hindsight and research? How do we overcome our own cultural obstacles?
It's such a good question, and it's one I really wrestled with, especially on November 9th. Because the whole time I was writing this book, one of my worries was that my book was going to, because Simon & Schuster wanted it to come out in 2017. They didn't want it to get in the way of the American election or the book, Madam President. But I always thought, okay, so my book is going to come out. And all my colleagues at the Times were making fun of me and saying, you're trying to come out in March with this Madam President book. People are going to think it's a book about Hillary Clinton. And it's not, you know, and I really, and then it's November and we're not going to have a female president. And I still have been struggling with why was it that Liberian women were able to do this and American women were not. You've got to look at sort of the thing I've come up with is in the United States, as you well know, black women went hugely for Hillary. Asian and Latino women did as well, but white women did not. Majority of white women went for Trump. And I don't really understand a lot of the reasons behind there. I think a lot of women just don't like Hillary. I think there's a lot of, you know, she was very polarizing. But the one thing that I've come down with was that in Liberia, for a woman to be elected president, she needs the vast majority of the female vote. Because a lot of men who normally would vote for her are not going to vote for her. There was no reason in the world for all those men who, I'm not talking about the young boys who were crazy about football. I'm talking about the grown men who knew better and knew this country had just come through 15 years of civil war for them to go and vote for a football player who had, you know, no college education to bring the, you know, thinking that made no sense at all. There were men with college degrees. There were men. He got support. George Weah got support from Winston Tubman, who is a Harvard-educated, you know, Liberian lawyer. And I asked him in the airport when I ran into him, going, "How could you support George Weah over Ellen Johnson Sirleaf?" And his reason he went in pontificating on the stuff about how he would have. But it's like when you think about the number of men who didn't vote for Ellen. You have to look at gender as a big part of that. And so in order for her to win, she never would have been able to do it without, you know, the female vote. And so that's the bottom line here. I think There's so many, when you look at how Hillary did with just the African-American male vote, she didn't get anywhere near the percentage of African-American men voting for her as Barack Obama did. And that has to, why would that be? That's got to be gender. Why else would they not be voting for her? What I ended up with was just that you're going to have to make your sale with the women, because it's going to take a lot more to get, because the men aren't, a lot of the men aren't going to vote for you.
Frank Roby, you have the last question.
Well, thank you. Hard enough to speak for a single person, which you've written a book about, let alone the country. I'm just going to go ahead and burden you with commenting on the entire continent of Africa. and that really is about, and many of us in this room have direct experience in Africa and with a number of Africans. I'm sensing, and just my relationships and as well as the things I read, that there's a diminishing interest happening with Africa. It's a combination of a strong dollar. It's harder to invest. It's oil independence. It's nationalism coming into play. It's a sense that we can't solve this problem. We like to throw a quick answer out there and say we fixed it. That's not really happening. And so my question is to you is really multifaceted. Number one is, like, do you see that yourself? Do you feel that? If you do feel it, how do you feel about it? Is that something that worries you or even deeply concerns you? And if it is, in fact, a void, if you feel it as well, where does that leave the continent relative to the influences that will come in or extend, like China being a typical example of that? Can you summarize all that for me?
And oh, sure.
It's just a real simple surface question.
Oh,
and you got my... Thanks a lot, Frank. Last time you get the last question. You get the first question next time.
I've never thought that, particularly here in this country, but I've never thought that people were ever that interested in Africa. I've always felt like when I first moved here, I felt like nobody cared about Africa. Certainly, I remember, you know, going to high school in Tennessee and then North Carolina and people not knowing what Liberia was, and I was outraged by that idea. Like, how could you not know Liberia? You know, I know America, but... So I think probably as an African, I've always felt that we were sort of under thought about, for want of a better word. I think that I hope that in many ways we're able to become more responsible for ourselves and take that, particularly now when you look at, we have a new administration here in Washington that you can bet is only thinking about Africa in terms of counterterrorism.
Yeah.
There's not a lot. Just look at what's going on with the budget proposals that Trump has come out with, although I don't think those are going to pass muster in Congress. But that said, it's still a case where, you know, I think the United States, the big thinkers here, when they look at Africa, they're thinking about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and they're thinking about, you know, ISIS, and they're thinking about Al-Shabaab, and they're thinking about the spread of radical Islam as it's moving south of the Sahara. But they're not thinking about sort of all of the things that feed into that, and the unemployment situation among young men and that sort of thing. And I think we do that to our own detriment here in the U.S. But you covered the whole span. I think Africans for many years spent too much time blaming the Europeans and colonialism for a lot of the ails in our own backyard. And I think we need to take a lot more responsibility for ourselves and our own, you know, our own lives. But I also do think that it's, you know, for America, you ignore this continent to your own detriment. I'll leave you with one example. I grew up in Liberia, and I remember as a child, we would go up country where we'd never see any white people, and then we'd see white people and go, white man, white man, white man, because that was a big deal to us. Running around. Now I'm making it sound like total bozos. I was up country last year with a friend of mine who's Greek, and she looks Greek. She's got dark hair, but, you know, she looks like a Greek woman. And everywhere we went, the entire time, people coming up to us and they're going, Chinese lady, Chinese lady, Chinese lady. And now in Liberia, Chinese is white. People, if you go to Liberia and you go to some parts of up country, people will look at you and say, Chinese man, Chinese man, Chinese man. And that's like, that says everything that you want to know about who's winning the battle for Africa. Mm.
And when you see how the budget may be cut for the State Department with foreign assistance, really underscores that. Ladies and gentlemen, Helene Cooper. So, it is my pleasure to present you with the official World Affairs Council scarf.
There's a World Affairs Council scarf?
It is. You know, I have a blue one, too, that I'll have to get you.
Yeah, you do.
And some of the books are pre-signed, but if you'd like Helene to sign it personally, just stick around, and she'll be right there going out with Alana. We'll see you at the next World Affairs Council event.
Thank you.
I was out of this world.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to look.